Mr. Bass, Rule 6. Until you, you...
Well, by the time we left Hong Kong, trips into China were just about beginning. It was still quite difficult for some people to get visas, but the door was opening. But of course, in more recent years, it's been exceptional. The way you just pick up a magazine and you can see a package tour, including the Great Wall of China, Tiananmen Square, all these famous places and that, and off you pop.
And did your Mandarin teachers use any different techniques for teaching you?
No. I think they had been instructed that we were servicemen learning Mandarin for particularly so that we could use it in a military atmosphere, because one or two of them were very quick to prevent us from using any military vocabulary. I know we had to quite often translate little stories, and one of the members of the course, he loved to bring in a little story about how many American aircraft were bombing the bridges in China, and the professor thumped the desk. "Please, Mr. So-and-so," and I won't give his name. "Please, Mr. So-and-so, we don't talk like that." You know, the use of terms like America and bombing in the same sentence was strictly off the record. So it was just learning the language, pure and simple. And any military vocabulary had to come once we were in the environment. This was all the instruction. I was only in the Air Force receiving instruction when the instruction was being given at the London School, London University. But later, the RAF started their own courses of instruction using native Chinese speakers brought over to this country and using service personnel who had experience in Hong Kong. And there, the military vocabulary was being widely taught. When I was in my last year in the Air Force, I had finished my second tour in Hong Kong, and my wife and I had come back to this country, and I was posted to RAF Tangmere. So I was then one of the instructors in Mandarin for the service personnel who were studying on the Chinese course. We also had some civilians who were being brought in and being instructed as well. Mainly, the instruction that I was giving was basically in numbers. So it was a question of giving them, mimicking a broadcast that would be coming over the air, giving out these four-figure blocks of numbers in quick succession, and for them to be writing them down. And because it was, I could do this either through a recording, record it on tape first and play back the tape, or do it live in front of them. But working from a script, then we could check each other's papers afterwards, you know, just pass your papers across and correct it. But learning the numbers is quite simple. But when you've got static and you know, coming over the radio and you're hearing all this, these garbled numbers, it can be quite different or difficult. And the Chinese realise that too. And so in Mandarin, for example, 1, 2, 3 would be yi, er, san. But yi, er, there's no consonant there. They're just vowel sounds. And over the air, with some static, they could be lost. So the Chinese changed the first two to yao and liang. So 1, 2 would be yao, liang. And so that it gives you something to grab onto and to focus in on. So, as I say, it was basic, taking them through the basic number training, very very basic to what they would be doing later on in life.
So how long did your Mandarin course SOAS take?
Yes, it was an academic year, so it ran from October through to July the next year. At the end of July, during my final year in the Air Force, as I say, when I was down at Tangmere, I was at that stage planning what I was going to do when I left the Air Force, and that was to work with the leprosy mission. And one of the officers, Flight Lieutenant Philip, he had been in Hong Kong. He'd been at the same church in membership, at the same church as my wife and I. So we did know each other socially as well as through the services. But he was in charge of the course when I was at Tangmere. And he knew what I was intending to do when I left the Air Force, what I wanted to do. And he very kindly suggested and made it possible, really, for me to go on a projectionist course, cinema projectionist course. So I went up to London, and for a week I was going into Air Ministry each day to learn how to operate cinema projection equipment. And, you know, these enormous reels of 35mm film and having two projectors, and how when you get to the end of the first reel, the sign comes up on the screen and you switch the second projector on and it starts running, and then you switch off the first and the second one takes over and all that. And it's very useful, because he said, well, when you leave the Air Force and you're working with the leprosy mission, you'll be doing... you'll be using a lot of visual aids, and you'll having to go around visiting groups, showing films. So this would be good training for you. And I thought, well, that was, you know, very good from him, his point of view, that he was putting it in my way, that I could gain experience at the RAF's expense for something that I was later going to do in my civilian life.
And so what happened to you after you finished that Mandarin course?
Well, after the Mandarin course, it was back to Hong Kong. And that was in 1957. It was in 1957 that I flew back to Hong Kong. And this time I flew back on a charter flight. It was a charter flight out of Blackbush, I think is in Wiltshire. Anyway, we took off in this. It was a Hermes aircraft, propeller driven. Airwork London was the charter company, and we flew off. And our first stop, I think, was Brindisi in Italy. Then we flew on to Karachi. Karachi to Calcutta was the next hop, and when we were approaching Calcutta, which was early morning, we'd been flying through quite heavy weather. It was the monsoon season, and we were flying through rain and storm and that all the time. We arrived about 5 in the morning near Calcutta, but we were stacked, and ground control had told the pilot to circle because there was traffic on the ground that was needing to be cleared. So we circled for about an hour, and then finally, and it was still, you couldn't see a thing outside, it was still thick mist and pouring rain, and we'd obviously been given the all clear to come in and land. But as we were coming down, I was sitting in a seat. The seats were rear facing, and so I was sitting by the port wing. I, looking out of the window, I could see the two engines on the port wing, and we came lower and lower, and suddenly the inner engine, the propellers, started to crumple. And then the pod, the whole engine pod, just disappeared underneath the aircraft, and there was a heavy landing, and the plane slewed, and we were sort of sliding sideways along the runway, and the crew from the cockpit, they or from the flight deck, they rushed through, abandon, and they were pushing out the emergency windows and opening the door at the back of the plane, and we just made our way out. We got down onto the tarmac and were told to make our way. We were walking across the tarmac, and when I looked back, I could see a second plane that had obviously crashed, and I thought, goodness me, every plane that's coming in this morning is crashing. And of course, later we were told that plane had been a cargo plane of Indian Airlines waiting to take off. And we had been given the clearance to come in and land by ground control. And coming out of the mist, and out of the pilot, well, he was just going on their instructions, and we just pancaked on the top of this Indian plane. All the crew of the Indian plane were killed. It was a small crew because it was a cargo plane. No one on our plane was hurt, but I put that down to the fact that all the seats were rear facing. So as we landed, we were being thrust back into the seats rather than being thrown forward as you would in a plane these days. But it did mean that our journey ended there at Dum Dum Airport, Calcutta. We were put up in the Grand Hotel, and we spent a couple of days there waiting for onward flight to Singapore. Most of us suffered with upset stomachs, I think. Probably delayed shock, or probably something to do with the sudden change of diet. But it wasn't a very pleasant stay in Calcutta. We didn't go out. Well, a couple of us decided that we would go out of the hotel and just have a look around. We went down the steps of the hotel, and immediately a couple of people came up to us and told us that we ought to take our fountain pens out of our pockets. They shouldn't be on display. Too easy to be stolen. So we took our fountain pens out of our pockets, turned around, and walked straight back into the hotel. So that's as much of Calcutta I saw on that particular occasion. But no, it was, my wife was in England at that time, and she had heard on the BBC News, and she said they reported it in a very sensible way by starting off by saying that no one was injured when a plane crashed. And they gave the details, and they went on to give the details of this air crash. But of course, she realised at the time that it could possibly be the plane that I was on. It was following the same route. But we were given facilities to write our letters home, and they were then taken by diplomatic bags so that they would get priority treatment. So it was fortunate that you know, no one had been hurt or injured on our plane. But one of the things I do remember, there was no panic on board when this happened, but I do remember that as we were walking across the tarmac, there was a mother with her two small children, and she said, "Oh, I'm sorry, dears, but we'll have to finish the story later."
What happened next?
Well, after that, we waited in Calcutta about a couple of days, and then we were flown on another charter plane through to Singapore, and then from Singapore, I flew on. It must have been RAF transport again. I think it was probably an RAF transport from Singapore up to Hong Kong. But no, I think it was the Calcutta incident that sort of stuck within the memory because it was so traumatic, whereas the onward flight from Singapore to Hong Kong was a bit vague. But I was glad to get back to Hong Kong. It was nice in a way because it was so familiar, and it was like sort of coming home.
And so this time you were a sergeant.
Yes.
So did that mean you had a different role up at?
Well, it was more an administrative role. It meant when I was back in Hong Kong, I was in charge of a watch. So I had very little direct intercept work to do. I was really keeping an ear on what other operators were doing, and maintaining the frequencies, seeing to the paperwork, liaising between the officers of the watch and the operators. So, as I say, it was more an administrative position. I think teachers have said, you know, as they climb the ladder, they get higher and higher and more promotion. They teach less and less. And I was in that position. I was doing less and less of what I'd been trained for, but I knew by then what other people should be doing, so I was able to keep tabs on them.
How would you keep tabs on
them? Well, you could always go around each position wearing a set of headphones and plug in to the second socket that they were listening, so you could always listen to what they were listening to, because having two sets, one had to maintain a watch on a certain frequency and search on another frequency, and sometimes if there was a sort of absence of traffic, it would be a question of perhaps suggesting certain certain frequencies they should be checking on, but a lot of it was just seeing that you know they were getting their necessary time off, because it can an 8-hour shift, you can't be listening to transmissions and static all the time. You've got to have some breaks. So organising break times and things like that was part of the sergeant's responsibility on each watch.
Okay, and that will be all up at Batty's Birmingham.
Yes, yes.
And was the shift pattern the same as it happened before?
Yes, it was. Yes. Yes, and this is why it was very difficult. When my wife was with me in Hong Kong, and that we had to carefully check the diaries in advance if we were invited out for a meal, and to know, not only to know whether I was on watch, but whether I was sleeping off, having just come off a watch, you know, that sort of thing. So, yes, diaries became very important in our lives.
And on either of your tours, while you were stationed at Battisville, were there any sort of memorable events where someone would pick up something particularly interesting?
Well, a lot of the tracking of Chinese military aircraft was really to see what they were doing, what patterns they were forming, whether they were just training exercises, or whether they were moving themselves around, or whatever. I can't really remember anything untoward that was happening. I do remember one officer who had not had language training, who was put in charge of a watch, got very excited on one occasion when he saw that one of our Chinese civilian operators had written in his log at the end of a transmission, "See again." And this officer, who had been, he had flown himself, he said, "Ah, now I know what they're doing. They are flying blind." He says, "You know, they have a cover. They pull the cover over their cockpit. They can't see a thing. They're flying on instruments only." And at the end, when everything's finished, "Right," they throw the cockpit back. "See again." Right. Satisfied. He knew what they'd been doing. Trouble was, "See again" was a direct translation of the Chinese word for cheerio. So, we didn't enlighten him, but he felt that he had contributed something to the traffic analysis of that day's intercept.
Were there any other sort of stories or memories you have of your period in Hong Kong?
As I say, from 1951, when I was called up, to 1961, when I left the Air Force, that 10-year period was all involved with language courses, Hong Kong, working in radio intercept, more language courses, language instruction for RAF Chinese courses. That was all a sort of a big bundle that has been wrapped up in my memory. And from 61 onwards, I feel that has been my life's work. And that, so it's very difficult. In fact, it wasn't until this recent contact that I began to sort of fish out a lot of that early history and my early impressions of the place. My daughter, who was born in Hong Kong, a couple of years ago, decided to go back. She hadn't been back since she left Hong Kong as a 9-year-old, and she decided to go back, more or less as a sort of pilgrimage. And when she came back, well, before she was going, people were saying, you're going to see a lot of changes. And when she came back, she said, people said, and were there a lot of changes? She said, it was a new place. She said, I wasn't visiting a place of my childhood. I was going to a new place and seeing it for the first time. But every now and again, something in my memory said, oh, I've been here before. Oh, that's how we got to this beach. Oh, yes, I remember that. But on the whole, it was a new place. And this is why I'm staggered by the photographs one sees of Hong Kong these days with these enormous skyscraper blocks. Because in the early 1950s and during the time of the Cold War, Hong Kong was developing, it was busy, it was bustling, but it was familiar and cozy. And to look at it now, I wouldn't want to go back. I couldn't go back because the place is not, the place is new. It's not as I would remember it. In fact, I think it would shatter all my memories, and I would be so distressed that I would rather remember the time that I did have there nostalgically, without ever having to face the fact that, well, even going to Hong Kong, I wouldn't be landing at that marvellous airport of Kai Tak with its finger of land thrust out into the harbour. I'd be landing on some man-made island on the other side of Lantau, and then being whisked into Hong Kong and the mass transit system, none of which was there during my time. So, as I say, I couldn't go back to Hong Kong, both physically or metaphorically.
Okay, and so how long was your second tour in Hong Kong?
Well, the second tour with the Air Force was from 1957 to very early 1961. So it was 2 full years. No, 3 full years, wasn't it? 58, 59, 60. 3 full years. And
you were working as the... Did you have the same role throughout your time?
Yes, yes. Yes, and I was stationed at RAF Little Saigon, living in the sergeant's mess, instead of one of the accommodation blocks where I'd been previously, but still working at Batty's Belvedere, and so having the trip up for peak to go on duty.
What was the journey like?
Well, I found it was refreshing, in as much as you were going through the busy, bustling traffic of Hong Kong, and then when you got to the bottom of the peak, you started going up through, first of all, through the mid-levels, where you'd got a lot of very smart mansions, lovely houses, a lot of lush vegetation. And then as you got higher and higher, the buildings became less and less. The final climb up was up a twisty, winding road. It was a paved road. And then you would come out to a small area of hard standing, where the gharry would turn around, or the 3-ton truck. We called them gharries. I think gharry came originally from the from the original servicemen in the Middle East. I think Gharry was an Egyptian term for probably a horse-drawn vehicle in the first instance. But we always called our three-ton trucks Gharries, and that would park. And while we walked up to the listening post and relieve the watch, they would come down, and then they would take that same vehicle back again down to Saiwan. But the journey was interesting. Sitting in the back of one of the lorries, you had got the benefit of the breeze. It made its own breeze as you went along, so it was cooling in the hot summer. In the rainy season, of course, one tended to sit as far forward as you could to avoid the rain coming in the open end of the rear of the vehicle. But once one was promoted to sergeant, you always had the privilege, unless there was an officer travelling, you always had the privilege of sitting up in the cab with the driver, but you relinquished that if there was an officer travelling with you. Most of the officers on watch had their own transport, I seem to remember, and they would turn up under their own power.